When one plans one of these conferences, as you can see by the past of the, by this program, sometimes I try to put together a very intense panel and then followed by a lighter side. In some other cases, like now, this afternoon, I was so happy when I got the letter from Brenda, and then a few days later, I got a call from London, from Alan Ward, because I found that these two presentations complement each other so wonderfully well. Here we have a case of cylinders being used, you see, for Afro-American music, and then we have another type of ethnic anthropological recordings. We all know the work of Fraser, his monumental Golden Bough, but not many people know that he also had apparently an intense interest for sound recordings to document those chants and music that he heard. So I was so happy, as I say, when I got a call from London from Alan Ward. He's the coordinator of the archival services of the United Kingdom's National Sound Archive in London. And he will tell us about the Fraser recordings at the National Sound Archives in London. So with great pleasure, Alan Ward.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm grateful to Carlos Hagen for inviting me to give this short talk. Two preliminary remarks. Firstly, the recordings I'll be playing later are cylinder transcriptions made by Lloyd Stickles of the National Sound Archive using this machine. Is that more or less in focus? Which some of you will have seen before. I think he's done a presentation to ask on the technology behind this. Characteristically, it's constructed of parts rifled from other standard equipment, notably the Revox parallel tracking arm on the top there. Our copying procedure involves making two copies simultaneously, one flat and one filtered and equalized to reduce background noise. No more elaborate electronic or physical cleaning up has been applied, and no attempt made to correct speed fluctuations. Speeds and sound quality have been selected subjectively and in some cases quite probably inexpertly and incorrectly. However, I have no more than a general knowledge of the technical side of the cylinder copying process. And secondly, unlike Brenda, I'm not a specialist in any of the subject matter of the recordings that I'm going to be playing. The first few illustrations I chose because of their intrinsic interest, and the later ones mainly because they were of good listenable quality without too much background noise. And I hope you'll bear with the hope you'll bear these points in mind when asking questions if there is time at the end. As I'm sure you are all well aware, Thomas Edison demonstrated his tinfoil phonograph in 1877 and then turned his attention to other matters for about 10 years, during which his basic concept was converted into a working recording machine by Bell and Tainter. Edison re-entered the field in 1888 with a wax cylinder phonograph, which owed many of its features to the Bell and Tainter's ideas. And the potential of Edison's new machine was quickly realized by at least a few scholars in the field of ethnography. And as Brenda was saying, as early as 1889, Jesse Walter Fuchs made his pioneering series of field recordings of Passamaquoddy and Zunyu Indians. This became the earliest of many sets of American recordings of traditional music and speech, and along with thousands of other cylinder recordings, they're now part of the collections of the Department of Folk Culture at the Library of Congress, which recently completed the copying and documentation of this collection in its federal cylinder project. Perhaps the most prolific and significant contributor was Francis Densmore, photographed here in Washington with one of her subjects, a Blackfoot chief, in 1906. Let me put the lights off this. The front lights perhaps might be a little clearer. In Europe, the possibility of duplicating ethnographic field recordings and distributing copies to interested scholars and institutions seems to have proved attractive. Erich von Hornbostel, working from the Psychological Institute at Berlin University, compiled various reference sets of molded duplicate cylinders, parts of which still survive in a number of institutions. The newly founded Vienna Phonogram Archive, shortly before the perfecting of the cylinder molding process around the turn of the century, decided on a wax desk recording using a specially developed cutting machine in order that the originals could be used to grow matrices for pressing short runs of duplicates for distribution using the Berliner Johnston technique. Here's a picture of the Vienna phonograph in use. You'll note the adaptation of local vegetation to extend the recording horn. In England, Edison's phonograph was initially publicised and promoted by Colonel George E. Gouro, seen here at his home, Little Menlo, named after Edison's HQ at Menlo Park, New Jersey, supposedly listening to a recorded message from Edison. And here he is giving what may have been the first recorded press interview with a reporter from the Pall Mall Gazette in July 1888. These are well-known pictures. The use of cylinders for recording folk song in the British Isles is also common knowledge. In the early years of this century, collectors such as Lucy Broadwood and the composer Ralph Vaughan Williams made field recordings on cylinders. There are even one or two reputedly recorded by Cecil Sharp himself. But the most active and committed of this group was the Australian pianist and composer Percy Grainger, who in 1906, during his period of residence in England, made a famous set of recordings of traditional singers in Lincolnshire, including Joseph Taylor, regarded by many as the greatest traditional singer of English folk songs ever to have been recorded. And this is Grainger with, as he liked to refer to first of them, his singers. Joseph Taylor's the one on the front left there, and Grainger's in the middle of the back row. Taylor's two-verse snatch, Brig Fair, formed the basis for Frederick Delius's orchestral composition of the same name. Again, the copying and distribution element is present, though in this case subject to considerable delay. After Grainger took up residence in the US, he arranged for his cylinders to be copied onto acetate discs. A picture of him supervising the process. And several sets of these were produced for lodgement in various repositories. Grainger personally delivered one such set to the British Institute of Recorded Sound, which is now the National Sound Archive, in the late 1950s, where it still resides. Now, everything I've mentioned so far is received information easily gathered from published sources, but what follows is rather less well known. To quote from the Dictionary of National Biography, in 1880, Alfred Haddon was appointed Professor of Zoology at the Royal College of Science in Dublin, while doing pioneer work there on the scientific classification of sea anemones. He developed an ethnographical interest in Western Irish life. In 1888 to 89, he went to the Torres Strait to study marine biology and returned with many specimens, but determined to record as much as possible of the life of the people before contact with Europeans had extinguished native custom. Now, the Torres Strait is the channel separating the north coast of Australia and Papua New Guinea. Haddon subsequently transferred most of his work to Cambridge University and organised an anthropological expedition to the Torres Strait Islands, which set off in the spring of 1898. Like Haddon, most of the participants in the expedition were specialist academics in related fields who were becoming involved in ethnology, but the linguistics expert chosen was already a specialist in the languages of the region. His name was Sidney Ray, and he appears to have advised Haddon to pack two phonographs and cylinders with the expedition's equipment. And this preliminary shopping list from Haddon's papers shows its inclusion along with a film camera. We've got a cinematograph here, two phonographs, cylinders, etc., all coming to £725. The machines chosen were Edison home phonographs. This one, I suppose. Ray's friends, the linguistic expert Ray, his friends held a farewell party for him at an address in Ilford in northeast London, during which some cylinder recordings were made. First we hear a little of the entertainment. Well,
of the song. For fears of their being calling through the belly of the day, the evil times of way. And this is my wedding morning.
That's enough of that. And then a series of goodwill messages were recorded, which are, I hope, but reasonably intelligible.
February 15, 1898. A few friends gathered together at 44 Fenton's Road with Sidney Rye and his friend Godspeed on their leaving for New Guinea at the notorious Strait. They wish them a successful visit and a safe return in good health.
Time in our life. And our friend Mr. Ray is going on a long journey. I trust he will reach there safe to return home to his dear wife who he left behind.
We are a company of friends assembled at the house of Mr. Crook of Kingston Road, Guildford, London, England. And we have been listening to a very interesting exhibition of the wonders of the gramophone by Mr. Ray, who is about to start in company with other friends on an exhibition to the Torres Strait, in which the party, a faithful rival there, and that the results that they hope to attain will be satisfactory.
Well, evidently a few drinks later, Ray responded to these messages and the proceedings ended in the time-honoured fashion.
Having this opportunity of showing the machine to you this evening, and thank you all much for your good wishes.
Well, the party set off, and the expedition was a considerable success in several respects. Haddon spent the rest of his life writing it up. His reports occupy 5 stout volumes, and many specimens, photographs, a short film of ceremonial dancing, and about 70 cylinder recordings have survived. Here's a picture of most of the main participants. Haddon is seated in the front. Ray is the rather shorter man here. And the others from left to right are W.H.R. Rivers, who was a psychologist, C.G. Seligman, who had started out as a pathologist and by this time was becoming an ethnologist, and the man on the end is A. Wilkin, who went along as a photographer. Among many rewarding features of the documentation produced by this expedition, not the least, is the light thrown on late Victorian men's beachwear under tropical conditions. Absent from the picture are 2 further psychologists, William McDougall, and perhaps most important of all, C.S. Myers, who was also a skilled musician and wrote the section on music in Haddon's reports based on the cylinder recordings. All the participants went on to become figures of national importance except Wilkin, the photographer, who contracted a fatal illness on a later expedition to Egypt a few years later. And this was certainly a loss, for he was clearly a very good photographer and took one of the best field recording pictures that I've ever seen. So this is it. That one's got everything, I think. A beautiful picture of the recorder and then the children in the front taking everything seriously and the ones at the back giggling. Now, here are some recordings from the expedition. Firstly, a song called Emara, accompanied by a drum, and the next slide shows, I think, this particular song being recorded. This rather mournful quality seems to have been characteristic, as is amply demonstrated by the following death wail, as performed at the graveside during a burial. Now a story called Ami Purunga, told by someone called Waria. Those previous ones were recorded on Murray Island, and this one was recorded on Mabueg Island. I've let those go on for a bit, although they're obviously unintelligible to most of you, I imagine, certainly to me, because they are the earliest items in the collection and the earliest ethnographic recordings which are held by us. One of the most active participants in the expedition, C.G. Seligman, was fully committed to ethnology by the end of the century and organised further expeditions. The best known of was his 1906 visit to Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, when he studied the Aboriginal inhabitants, the Vedas, who recorded their music. Only one of their tunes had more than five notes in it, and wrote the definitive study of the tribe, to which Myers again contributed the music chapter. That's Seligman in later life and his long-term buddy Myers. Prior to this, in 1904, Seligman visited New Guinea and the Trobriand Islands, and these are a couple of recordings he made on that trip. His vocal announcements are heard at the start of each cylinder.
Ote Boita, a song song at the Kaiwak Romila Mala by Tobita. Trobriand Islands, September 1904. Let's see, my daughter, that water, a hot water, that's a good one.
Gallo Gallo, a Motu song, sung when hauling captive dugong alongside the canoe. Hanua Bada, October 1904.
Keep going, please. Again, please. So I'm getting slightly confused here because both the buttons on the projector seem to be sending the slides in the same direction. I was trying to get back to the place where I was originally, but anyway. I think that this is probably okay. We'll see how we get on. Those are two examples of recordings made by Seligman in Papua New Guinea in 1904. C.S. Myers, who did all the musical transcriptions and investigations into the cylinders, had all the cylinders from the Cambridge Group expeditions through his hands. But around 1905, he seems to have passed them over to J.G. Fraser, the author of The Golden Bough, regarded as the crowning achievement or supreme folly of 19th century social anthropology, depending on your point of view. Fraser lived and worked in Cambridge and knew Haddon and his associates quite well. He was almost entirely an armchair anthropologist. He certainly never carried out any field work and probably never listened to the cylinders he collected. He adopted the role of a clearinghouse for anthropological information, and at least in the case of the cylinders, got his wife to do the actual work. By about 1907, the Frasers were commissioning recordings from travellers, missionaries, or government agents, advising on recording apparatus and supplying blank cylinders. And here's the rim of one of the cylinders. As you can see, it's got Mrs. Fraser's name imprinted in it. I knew we'd manage that. Can we run them? Can we have it back again? Two items, please. Sorry about this. I'll put that one in upside down anyway, but there's one right way up. Yeah, back two, something like that. That's it. One before. Lovely. We'll stick with this now. This is the lid off a typical Fraser cylinder with Mrs. Fraser's special label and their address on it. And it contains a recording made on a South American expedition by W.F. Cooper of Watford in about 1910. You can see the specially printed label, and this is a duplicate of the original made by W.H. Manning of the Solar Physics Laboratory in Cambridge. We know this from his handwriting. He appears to have offered this copying service in his spare time. The red numbers and the other information on the lids are in Fraser's handwriting, but it's not surprising, but not surprisingly, they bear no relation to the individual cylinder contents. Because Fraser was no archivist. Again, we see the emphasis on providing copies for use by other interested parties. Duplicates of various cylinders were sent to such institutions as the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford and the Royal Anthropological Institute in London. All the duplicates were made on wax blanks, presumably by means of a pantographic duplicating machine like this one. And there should be a couple of slides ahead. There we are. The Frasers didn't attempt, as far as we know, to produce brass shells in which moulded duplicates could be made, as Hornbostel had done. The most prolific of Fraser's agents was N.W. Thomas, who was appointed as an official anthropologist in British West Africa by the Colonial Office. Partly in order to justify his appointment by results, he worked at a prodigious speed, collecting artifacts and taking photographs and making cylinder recordings. Some of his letters are found among Fraser's papers. Now, this is a contemporary typed transcript of one of them, written on the 17th of June 1909. In the last paragraph there, you can see on the question of cylinders, he writes, "Please thank Mrs. Fraser for the blanks. The boxes arrived with six postal stampings on each. Pitch pipe also very useful. I tour for some months more and want more blanks. P.S. As fit as a fiddle, cover 20 miles easily." That's presumably per day. It's no surprise that over half the cylinders collected by Fraser, amounting to about 1,200 altogether, were recorded by N.W. Thomas, and that on the whole, the recording quality gives evidence of hasty work. Another traveller who provided Fraser with cylinder recordings was A.H. Fox Strangways, who later founded and edited the journal Music and Letters. In 1911, he toured India collecting material for his well-known book, The Music of Hindustan, which appeared in 1914. Among a few allusions to cylinder recording in the book, he wrote of the singer Chandra Prabhu, "She compelled respect at once by refusing on any account to be phonographed. Perhaps she thought, amongst other things, that if she committed her soul to a mere piece of wax, it might get broken in the train. And my subsequent experience showed that this was all too likely." But about 80 of Fox Strangways' recordings did survive and give evidence of skillful work. The first example is of a snake charmer demonstrating the pitch of the drones on his bagpipes. Fox Strangways sounds a pitch pipe before each section. The next thing is a singer called Javadi Taluga singing a song called Kanbadi Adi. This is information from the cylinder lid. I don't know anything more about it. Uh, Our next, a Sindhi love song from Baluchistan, sung by a lady called Sassy, a lady with a cough.
Sindhi love song. Allah dai kanda la ke to dayo dar dai ke ravada layo kahe kanda la ke to dayo dil mujhe itni tak ke nazar aaye wal pirne ka mazar to tak dar dar se ramit dil ayo kahe kanda
And finally, from this little group, almost the final item, actually, two pipes called Cernays, accompanied by a drum called a dole. This is probably the most technically impressive recording I've heard in the whole of this collection, though the contents are perhaps a little short of riveting. Fraser's collection also includes 150 or so cylinders recorded by Alice Werner in Kenya and Tanzania, and a number of smaller accumulations from Africa, India and elsewhere. This short period of international recording activity by British travellers ceased with World War I. Fraser's collection languished in the Department of Psychology in Cambridge until the then professor arranged to transfer it to the British Institute of Recorded Sound in the late 1950s. There was then a further delay of 20 years, until some preliminary sorting was attempted by the newly arrived ethnomusicologist on the BIRS staff. Serious dubbing work had to wait until 1982, when the machine I illustrated earlier was ready and some more thorough sorting had been carried out by me, based largely on the paleographic evidence on the cylinder boxes and lids. Most of the cylinders have now been dubbed, and after another lull, we hope to finish the copying job altogether. There are about 2,200 of them by the end of this year. And to finish, I'll play a recording from another important set acquired by Fraser. These were recordings of Aboriginal music and ceremony made by Sir Baldwin Spencer in the Northern Territory of Australia and on Bathurst Island. This one was recorded on the 15th of November, 1912. La 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 Thank you.